Now, what I'm going to do is ask you some things about yourself.
Okay.
Where are you from and how you got started and this sort of thing?
Well, I'm a real New York kid. I was born in the Bronx, raised in the Bronx, and most of my married life was spent in Manhattan. I had my kids in Manhattan in the suburbs. I got started as a writer, I would say, because my mother wanted me to be a writer. Encouraged me in every way, and I always had praise for that. I was not a student. I was a crazy, restless kid, but the only thing that I always consistently did was write and get patted on the head for the way I wrote.
You wrote when you were very young?
Yeah, yeah. I wrote before I could write. I dictated to my mother, and she wrote some poems when I was just before I started school, and she wrote them down. A robin sat up in a tree and sang a little song to me, you know, stuff like that.
Isn't that interesting? What was your mother?
My mother was a first grade teacher primarily, and my father was a middle class home. My father was a textile converter. My mother, they were cultured people.
So you had very early encouragement.
Huh? Absolutely.
Where did you go to school?
I went to City College, but I dropped out when I married for the first time. Which was in 1954, and I was trying to write a book. It was a novella, actually, and I was working, and I was going to school, and I looked around, and I was being a housewife and cooking, you know, and so on. Not that I've stopped that, but at some point I looked around and said, something's got to go, and school was the least pressing of my concerns, and so school went.
What were you studying in school?
I was an English major. There was never any doubt about what I was going to do. That was why I had the courage, really, to not finish, and to, when I did work, to always take jobs that would not be too challenging. At some point, I actually took one job that was in a fairly interesting place, on a magazine, and then I quit after a while and took a speed writing course, and got a job in a real estate office, because I remember saying to my husband, if I stay at this place, I will never write a book. And that's always my feeling about publishing. It's unhealthy for writers to be there.
Unhealthy for a writer?
Well, first of all, because the work is compelling enough to divert you from your own. And I think there's something about the whole business of being in publishing that is seductive. It's easier than actually sitting down and writing books. And in the long run, you just get lured away. I know many talented writers who work as editors and so on, and maybe some of them would have gone on to write books if they had not found a career that was on its way to being a satisfying.
In your earliest beginnings, your goal obviously was to become a writer, but did you set a form for yourself as a writer? Did you want to write Gothic? Did you want to write a bestseller? Did you want to write an
academic
novel?
I'm not sure I ever
novel?
Knew there were even categories.
Turns out there are.
Yeah. Yeah, but I'm not sure that I think that all of us resist thinking of ourselves as category writers, and I have a feeling that even those ladies who sit down and turn out Gothic romances really would be perfectly happy if someone said, well, this is a novel. It happens to be very romantic, but it's a fine novel, because I believe that we all take what we do quite seriously, no matter how the rest of the world takes it.
Tell me about your first novel and how that came about.
Well, it was called To the Precipice, and it came about because, well, I had written a lot of short stories, and I had a lot of beautiful rejection slips from ladies' magazines that said things like that she just doesn't wear sufficiently rose-colored glasses for us, and from the little magazines that thought I had some talent, but I just wasn't whatever. Little enough. I didn't. Well, quiet enough writer, I think, would maybe be the word. And then I wrote a novel, and my agent, who I had great regard for, didn't like it, and I put it away. And then I had my first child. She was a baby, actually, when I had her. And then I started writing again, and I started To the Precipice, which was... as is true of all my books, and not apparently autobiographical novel. It wasn't the first novel. Of my first three books, the three books before Good Bar, Precipice was probably the most innately commercial. That it was the one that had a possibility. If I wrote something like that now, it would probably sell well. It was a story. It wasn't your quiet first novel that people have regard for, but that doesn't get off the shelves. But of course, it didn't get off the shelves either, because they don't.
You didn't dust off your first novel and try to
No, it was reissued in paperback after Goodbar was a success, as all my early books were.
Well, the one you put aside.
The one I put aside, oh, well, there's actually sort of a funny, long, long, funny story attached to that. But no, nothing. It really wasn't good. I really, what my agent had said was that it didn't have the life that my short stories had, that it was so quiet and had bored him. And there's nothing I dread more than being bored. My God.
You've always been, Chris, you're a New Yorker. You must like the urban setting quite a bit, is that correct?
Well, I guess what I like is extreme settings. I like extreme settings and extreme people because they're more interesting. Almost all my books have taken place either in New York or in New England, which is extreme in an almost opposite way. Cold and lonely place so much of the year where people drink more, brood more, and don't have the diversions that they have in the city from their own depressions and problems.
You will always be remembered for looking for Mr. Goodbar. Did you anticipate the success of that book?
God, no. I wanted to write. At that point, I'd been divorced. I'd come back to New York with my children. This was the end of 71, and I took a secretarial job because I didn't want responsibility and because I was going to write. I had finished my third novel, and I started Attachments, actually. And then at some point, by this time I was about 36 years old, I think, and I began to feel as though I was in drag being a secretary at that age. It was too silly, three published novels, and I'm mother of two children, and I'm working as a secretary, and I started wanting to earn enough money to stay home and write books. My idea, when the woman was murdered in New York, who inspired the book, my original idea was to write. Nora Ephron had asked if I would do something for this woman's issue of Esquire that she was putting together, and I said, well, how about a piece on this woman who was murdered and whether it's okay for women to be hanging around in singles bars picking up men just because the 70s say it's all right and so on. And she liked the idea, but the Esquire lawyers vetoed it on the grounds of the rights of the defendant, who was still alive. He later killed himself. And so I said, well, it's just as well. I'm a terrible journalist. I'll do it as a novel. And what was on my mind was very specific, that if I wrote a novel that had sex and violence in it, I would maybe be lucky enough to have a paperback sale of $35,000, of which I would get half, and that would be enough for me to stop working in an office for 2 years. That was exactly, I was making $10,000 a year as a secretary, and $17,000 would carry me almost as far as that, and then I would go back to being a secretary after a couple of years if necessary. And even when the money thing started happening with Goodbar, when it was a book club selection, it was, oh, maybe another 6 months without secretarial work, maybe another year or two. As a matter of fact, I think that was one of the ways I handled the success, I think, which would have been too frightening to me to contemplate as a permanent change in my existence and maybe an alteration in my identity. I needed to have that anchor. I could always go, that drab life awaiting me at the end of whatever period I'd have of not having to do it.
Of course, the movie version made it even more visible. And,
very, yeah.
Did you have any role in the movie version of Looking for Mr. Goodbar?
Only at the bank.
Mm-hmm. Did the movie make you happy? Many writers will see a movie version of one of their books. Robin Cook, for example, I did an interview with him yesterday. And I'm sure you're probably familiar with some of his work. He's a popular writer, writes mostly medical thrillers.
Right.
But he had been very dissatisfied with a book called Sphinx, which was turned into a movie, and with Coma. His book called Fever, he is going to produce himself so that he can make sure it's the way he wants it.
Yeah, I know that Wombo did that with one of his books, and I gather he did a quiet, respectable job that maybe didn't have some of the virtues that a bad movie would have had, but didn't have some of the flaws either. I don't know. If there are writers who are really happy with their movies, I don't know them. Nor do I know any who have reason to be. When you look at a luminous book like Ragtime, and see what they did with what one a really talented, intelligent movie maker did with it, it's still a crime, you know.
Well, they did all right with Sophie's Choice.
Yes.
And I thought Goodbar was a good
French Lieutenant's
movie.
Woman. Well, I know a lot of people who did. I know a lot of people who I respect who thought Goodbar was a good movie, and therefore I'm forced to say that it may just be in the nature of things that one does not love anything that changes one's baby around that much, you know.
I think you expressed that very well.
Yeah.
And very subtly. August, have you been psychoanalyzed?
Oh, sure. There'd be no way to write a book like that without having a real sense of the experience.
Uh-huh. Tell me about August, and tell me about the experience of going through analysis.
Well, in 25 words or less, that's right.
Well, take your time. Make it 50.
Well, August is about two women, a psychoanalyst named Lulu Scheinfeld, with a background that in many ways is close to my own. New York, Jewish, fast, funny, whatever. How shall we say it? And a young girl who enters her office one day, who is an 18-year-old New England sort of beauty queen walking around with terrible feelings about what the men who like her, for example, would think of her if they knew what she was really like inside. She feels disassociated from this beautiful creature that presents itself to the world. And the book follows their parallel lives. Dawn Henley is the name of the young girl, and Dawn has had an very extreme childhood. Lulu has had a middle-class childhood, which has cushioned her from... There have been no extreme disruptions in her life. She did not physically lose her mother and father, for example, at an early age, as Dawn did. Would get raised by a couple who was a rather bizarre couple by normal standards. And what the book does is to follow their parallel lives during a five-year period. Dawn's is followed entirely through her analytic sessions, and we see what she sees only through her eyes, which, of course, is the way it is in analysis. And we see her trying to know more about her patient, about her doctor, than she can with her intense absorption in what the doctor is really like, what she really does, and so on. Which characterizes patients in analysis, because patients become extremely absorbed in this powerful figure who is, in theory and ideally in practice, going to help them change their lives very much for the better. And we also see that Lulu's life out of the sessions is not under quite the same kind of calm professional control as her life in the sessions. She's a competent analyst, but her own life is a little wacky, as so many people's are now. She herself has been divorced, has adolescent children, has various whatever husbands, love affairs, and so on. And but eventually, is in some sense also able to use the knowledge that she has of herself from her analytic training to help her own life. Various people have said, boy, she's got some crazy life. Her life does not seem all that crazy to me when I look around me, except to the extent that almost all lives that go on in an urban setting in the latter part of the 20th century are crazy.
Did analysis help you?
Oh, sure.
Because it's often said that no one is ever cured by analysis. They just quit.
Well, you didn't ask if it cured me. I said it helped. And what I think is true is that in some sense, a lot of people enter hoping to be cured of life. Life is difficult, and analysis can't really do very much about that. All it can do is help one to deal with life in the present instead of being constantly under the domination of past events and expecting it to, expecting life to lead one as it did when one was a helpless child, and to the extent that one's expectations determine the outcome, constantly affecting for the worse one's current life. What it helps you to do is separate the past from the present so that you can deal with the present with all its difficulties in the most effective way. I mean, and psychoanalysis cannot help me to deal with the fact that on the day when I ran to the door to get the Times because I knew my daily review was in it, the first thing that hit me was that the House had passed the MX missile, which I believe is the beginning of the end if it goes through. Now, my analyst can't do anything about that. No analyst. Nobody. No, I mean, it seems as though politicians can't. They get a phone call from Ronald Reagan and they say, well, you know, what the hell, that's the boss. Never mind if it's the end of the world. Analysis can only help us to deal in the best way possible with the present, and our present is wildly, ghastly complicated. You know?
Judith, August is obviously a radically different theme from looking for Mr. Goodbar. Many in Hollywood, there's a saying that once you do something right, do it again. And yeah, many authors try to draw on what they've done before. For example, John Irving, when he wrote The Hotel New Hampshire, it was almost, to me, it was almost the same thing as Garp.
Same themes, but removed of their energy. It was amazing. It was a hollow book. It had all his old stuff in it, but the old stuff that worked in Garp and in his earlier books just stopped working there. Yeah. Well, my friend Eleanor Bergstein once said that Hollywood was the only place where you would go out and present something to a studio head and he'd say, I've never heard that idea before, and it wasn't a compliment.
Well, how does a writer stop duplicating himself?
But how do you start? I mean, I think that we all do. I mean, I see common threads in all my books. Other people tend to see what's wildly different in them, and I tend to see what's similar, so that I see, for example, enormous similarity between Looking for Mr. Goodbar and Emmeline, which is a story that takes place in the 19th century about a 14-year-old Baptist who goes off to work in the cotton mills of Lowell and is seduced by her employer. And to me, Goodbar is a 20th century Emmeline. They're about young girls who are or who have had some disjuncture in their childhood or adolescence, feel taken away prematurely from their mothers and or their fathers, and plunge into affairs that Teresa Dunn's first affair is with a married man, as is this, and this man who seduces Emmeline is a married man, and what that has to do with is not certainly not being ready for a real relationship with an available man, but still looking for something that they were torn away from prematurely.
Judith, when you mention the Dunns, it just occurred to me that for someone like yourself, brought up in a Jewish household, you were certainly hard on the Catholics in that book. You made the father extremely unflattering, as I recall.
Oh,
I thought he was.
Oh, no. What I was trying to show in that book was that, no, I think, are you thinking of Lacey Fosberg's book?
No.
You're not thinking of Goodbar? Because the parents are pictured as ordinary, decent, hardworking people, and Teresa's problems stem from what her mind did with the ghastly events of her childhood, the polio, which she took as a punishment, and so on. It's not an unflattering picture at all, and I think there's a reason. I never had any difficulty with those people, any threats of. As a matter of fact, unless I'm mistaken, I made the family a little bit more savory than it actually was.
One or two other questions quickly. Obviously, you're not going to go back to the secretarial job. You have
not this year.
Cushioned from that forever.
Yeah.
How do you, so I know a little bit about how you work. Do you, how do you approach a book? Do you have a private place for you to work if you don't have
to?
You live in Manhattan, don't you?
Yes, I live in Manhattan, and for the past couple of years. I wrote August primarily at a place called the Writer's Room, which is an extraordinary and wonderful place where people go at a very, very reasonable price if they don't have money. Those of us who earn more money contribute to the room, but it's run on grants and private contributions, and there are about 20 desks, and you can go there at any time of the day or night, 7 days a week, and write, and it's heaven. For a variety of reasons.
20 desks in one big office?
Yes, with semi-partitions and no conversation. The only sound is the sound of typewriters. You have to go outside if you want to talk. There's a kitchen and a bathroom and about 20 desks and your own typewriter.
Sounds like a newsroom.
Well, a lot of people say that, and it's true, except that there isn't the noise. I mean, people who really need a lot of space and who need... There are people who need to work alone, and there are many others, more women, I think, than men, who like this. For me, since I sink into what I'm doing in the way that I do, and I always feel as though I'm in danger of drowning under the waves of what's coming forth, for me, the knowledge that there are other people around in itself provides some kind of basic comfort that cannot be overestimated.
You wouldn't find it preferable, a quiet place, completely private in your own home?
No, the important quality of the place is that it not be home. That does, here again, that seems to be more true for women than for men, partly because men who work at home often have wives or women who are there protecting them from the events of life. They have a study without a phone and don't feel obliged to keep the home running. Women are much more likely, if I am home, and this seems to be true of most of my friends at the room and who aren't at the room, that we tend to get caught up in the events of life. Or if the phone starts ringing, you have on your machine, and then you say, oh my God, maybe it's so-and-so who needs me, or so-and-so had her baby, or this happened, or that happened, and pick up the phone. So the important thing is to be removed from the daily concerns.
Do you establish a specific time, work time for yourself, a schedule?
I do.
Yourself?
I don't know that all people do. I'm extremely disciplined, actually, as writers go, it appears. And I work, at the beginning of a book, I set myself, say, about 9 in the morning to 11 or 12, just 2 or 3 hours. And then as the book goes on, it sort of takes over and I don't have to discipline myself at all. And by the end of a book, I'm working all the time, 14, 16 hours a day often.
One last question.
Sure.
This is for a little separate feature I'm doing on what people like to read.
Yeah.
All sorts of people, from doormen to firemen to writers.
Right.
And when you're... off duty, what do you like to read?
Right. Well, at the end of a book, I'm never off duty, and I'm incapable of looking at anything that does not touch on my work in any way. But in between and at the beginning, I read a lot of good fiction. Of course, there are a lot of wonderful American women writers around right now. And I've read both Joe McGinnis's marvelous account of Going to Extremes, it's called, and now I'm reading John McPhee, who's an absolutely extraordinary, delicious writer, and I'm reading poetry. I'm reading Edna St. Vincent Millay now because my friend Nancy Milford is writing a biography of her. That's sort of reawakened my interest in her. And then I read little snatches of things that I get caught up in. The big problem for me is to sit down and finish a book and not be thrown by all the galleys and books that are sent for comment and so on. The books I've just bought are a book called Alice in Bed and another one called Housekeeping, both by two young women that I understand are very special.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.